Hi, everyone. Good evening. I want to just begin with a very short introduction to this series and what I hope to try and do over these three Monday evenings. So the claim that I would like to persuade the world of is essentially this one. Judaism is, at its core, a story about love. It's a story about a God of love who summons people to lives of love. People, human beings, who are always already loved by God, are called to A, reciprocate God's love, ve'ahavta Adonai Elohecha, to love our neighbor, ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, and, most radically, to love the stranger, the ger, the vulnerable outsider who lives among us. We are invited to imitate God, lalechet bidrachav, which in Jewish tradition is about living in compassionate ways, being present with people as they endure moments of deep suffering and vulnerability. That is at the heart of the covenant between God and the Jewish people. And yet, popular perceptions of Judaism, for a number of reasons, among both Jews and Christians, often tell a very different story. And there's a bunch of reasons for that, and very quickly I'll just enumerate a couple. One is that the history of Christian anti-Judaism, right, essentially relentlessly portrayed Judaism as a lifeless and loveless tradition, as a tradition that was married to the deadness of the law. All these things are no doubt familiar to many of you, and that had no real notion of the love of God, let alone the notion that our own lives were supposed to be oriented around love. That caricature of Judaism was so widespread, and to some extent still is, that even many Jews have accepted and internalized it, and in one of the great ironic turns in 20th century Jewish thought, we even had a few 20th century Jewish thinkers who proclaimed it proudly. We could talk about that later. But more than that, as I have said in public lectures at Hadar many times over the years, at a certain point in American Jewish history, in part, I imagine, because of the tenuousness of people's own Jewish education and identity, Jews began to define Judaism as whatever they imagined Christianity was not. And so, because Christianity was about love, Judaism was about something else. Justice, law, you could pick your example. There are many examples of this, and if you're kind of interested in intellectual history, you realize that these examples are sort of preposterous, right? Generations of Hebrew school students in this country have been taught, for example, that Judaism has no notion of the afterlife, right? The reason they were taught this is because Jews thought that Christianity was totally otherworldly centered. And so we had no notion of an afterlife, which, of course, would have been news to any Jewish thinker in the whole history of Jewish thought. I mean, the problem with that presentation is it's totally false, right? Or another example, and this I have had happen to me on countless occasions, people will come up to me after I give a shiur or a lecture on a topic like this, and they'll say, so tell me something, is grace a Jewish idea, right? So I often hand them a paragraph in Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed where Maimonides says, here's the definition of chesed. I owe you nothing, but I choose to give you something anyway. Translate that into one word, that's grace, right? And the list goes on and on. Another related example that I will try to deal with in my third presentation is the notion that while Christianity worships a God who's about love, Judaism worships a God who is, I don't know, if you're interested in the history of anti-Judaism, wrathful, cruel. By the way, this is one of the last permissible cultural stereotypes, meaning you can even in the New Yorker refer to the wrath of the Old Testament God and it's fine, right? Never mind that it's, to be generous, unnuanced, right? That's a very generous way of putting it. So I want to try to kind of really think about how the biblical God is a God of love. So the project that I'm engaged in and that these lectures are a part of is essentially about restoration and reclamation. The restoration and reclamation of love as the core of the Jewish tradition, or, if I could, restoring the heart in both senses of the covenant between God and the Jewish people. Now, I would be remiss and accused of being polemical if I didn't add one last thing to this introduction, which is that there is also an internal Jewish dynamic here, because Judaism has always underscored the centrality of concrete action in the spiritual life. After all genuine emotions express themselves concretely in the world. Compassion without attendant acts of kindness, for example, is probably not compassion, but emotional self-pleasuring, if you will, right? Oh, isn't it amazing how compassionate I am for other people? What's for dinner, right? As opposed to really asking what are the ways in which being a compassionate person really translates into a set of obligations and actions in the world. But already in the medieval period, Rabbeinu Bachya ibn Pakuda, one of the great Jewish thinkers of the Middle Ages, lamented the ways that had been distorted into essentially a situation where Jews focused on obligations of the limbs, chavot ha'evarim, and ceased talking about obligations of the heart, chavot halvavot, hence the title of his book. And always, Jewish thinkers emerged who said, let's be careful about something. Actions are expressions of something deeper, or they are kind of nothing at all. And it's that something deeper that I would like to help restore to our conversation. So tonight, we're going to talk about loving the neighbor, an ocean of a topic which we will only kind of skim at. Next week, we'll ask the question of whether loving your enemies is a Jewish value. That is a really hard question, which we will probe at and not answer well. And then again in the third week, the notion that the God of Torah and of Judaism more broadly is a God of love. In each of these lectures as I go, I will say I'm going to stop along the way and raise some questions I am still trying to think through, and I look forward to your brief responses, questions, challenges during the back and forth. So with that, love your neighbor as yourself. I just very briefly want to take a minute and ask for three people in a maximum of 1.5 sentences. Tell me when you hear the words, ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, what do you imagine that verse is asking of you? And you don't have to say something earth-shattering, so don't be afraid to talk, right? Just like, what comes up? What do you think about? Yeah, please.
Do for them what you want for yourself.
Do for them what you want for yourself. And is that something you were taught, or that's just the way you hear the verse, or some combination?
I heard it in a class.
You heard it in a class. So docile. Okay, great. Thank you. We'll see that that's one of the main interpretations of that verse in Jewish interpretation. Other people? Yeah, please.
That you have to begin with your love of self and then extend that to all the people that you come in contact with.
Okay, did people hear that? The second statement was that you have to begin with love of self and then extend that to other people. So I would like to propose, I mean, maybe I'll get a chance to talk about this later. There are a good number of Jewish thinkers who will make an argument like that. I, for whatever it's worth, I do not think that is the biblical assumption. And I'll show you later, I don't think there is a biblical mandate to love the self. That doesn't mean there isn't the biblical assumption that people do love themselves. Okay, well, so I want to come back to that because that's actually a very provocative comment. Yeah, please, you get the last word. Don't blow it. No, I'm just kidding, go ahead.
To translate it into a negative, don't stand idly by. Like, I think, you know, like, I think the opposite of loving your neighbor is more or less standing idly by. So to view it from the negative perspective would be,
don't stand idly by, meaning you're suggesting that the opposite of love is indifference or apathy as opposed to hatred. Am I hearing you correctly? Or
It's not exactly the opposite, but sometimes it's the more common of the two.
Sometimes it's?
It's the more common of the two.
Okay. So great. Thank you. So look at the verse for a minute, okay? And actually, two verses, which are a unit, and it's probably useful to look at them together, right? Lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha. You shall not hate your brother, your kinsperson, in your heart. Hocheach tochiach et amitecha. Rather, reprove this fellow member of the covenant. Velo tisa alav chet. These next few words have been subject to an endless array of interpretation. Incur no guilt because of him. You could begin to imagine all the ways that phrase might operate. I don't want to focus on that now. Lo tikom velo titor. Do not take vengeance or bear a grudge. Et b'nei amecha, the people of your the members of your people. Ve'avta l'reacha kamocha. Ve here should probably be translated as but. Or but rather, right? Do not take vengeance or bear a grudge, but rather love your neighbor, your fellow, probably more accurately, as yourself. Ani Hashem, I am God. Okay? If you look at the second source, you will see the famous line where Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest and most influential sages of the Talmud, declares, Zeklal gadol b'Torah. And we're going to talk later, I hope at some length, about what that phrase might mean. This is the great principle, or perhaps a great principle, of the Torah. Now, whatever that means, it's also striking, by the way, that modern biblical scholarship ends up saying the same thing. A variety of modern biblical scholars refer to Leviticus 19:18 as the apex, or the epicenter, of Sefer Vayikra. The problem, of course, is if you call something a klal gadol and no one can quite agree about what it actually means, that, my friend, is Judaism, right? So because it elicits an enormously interesting ongoing conversation. So a good way to get started with this, I think, is to take each word in turn and think about the questions or possibilities that it raises, okay? So bear with me for a minute as we do this, right? First of all, ve'ahavta, love. So first of all, what is being asked for here? Emotions? Actions? Or some combination, or perhaps the better word, integration of both? Now, if emotions are what's asked for here, or are even part of what's asked for here, then we have to ask, can emotions be commanded? Can emotions be controlled? Because if emotions can't be controlled, then neither, it would seem, can they be commanded. You can't be asked to do what you can't do. Because, as a great non-Jewish philosopher said, ought presumably implies can. Right? If you're asked for an emotion, the presumption is, it would seem at least, that you're able to control your own emotions. I will argue later, for what it's worth, that the truism about human beings not being able to control our emotions needs to be radically and fundamentally rethought. That is as false as it is widespread. And I'll try to explain that and defend it a little later. Now, if love, in an emotional sense, is being asked for here, what kind of love are we talking about? Surely I am not asked to love the neighbor down the block in the same way as I love my child or my wife. So what kind of love are we talking about? By the way, remember, we're on the first word here, right? You could say that much of the history of Jewish ethics can be essentially forced into this kind of attempt to understand what is this verse actually talking about. And then fourth, much more technically, but no less relevantly, what are we to make of the somewhat odd Hebrew formulation, ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, which you could hyper-literally translate as, you should love for your neighbor as you love yourself, as opposed to ve'ahavta et reacha, or whatever it might be, okay? Those are four small questions. Now, v'avta l'reacha. So as Jesus is asked in the Gospel of Luke, who is my neighbor? Or more accurately, who is my fellow? Who is the Torah talking about here? First, is it talking about fellow Jews or all human beings? And second, and this is something I'm going to get a chance, I hope, to talk about at least somewhat next week, if it's talking about Jews, are all Jews without exception included within this? Answers to this, all over the map. Kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. Let's assume for a moment that the commandment makes a claim on my emotional life. It is asking me about feeling a certain way. Maybe it's possible to love others, you would say. But is it really possible to love them as much as or in the same way as I love myself? And if the answer to that in your mind is obviously not, then what does this word kamocha mean? And more than that, even if it were possible for me to love you in the same way that I love myself, would that be a desirable goal, either ethically or psychologically? Right? This last question, by the way, and we'll see this in some detail later, preoccupies many Jewish thinkers and shapes the way they interpret this verse, because at least where life and death are concerned, halacha seems pretty clear that my life comes before other people's lives. And therefore, there seems to be some degree of what philosophers would call self-preference built into Jewish ethics. Now, just to be clear, because the term self-preference can lead people astray, self-preference has nothing to do with egoism. If we lived our life loving our neighbors, even with self-preference, all of us would live radically different lives than we live. Self-preference doesn't mean I get to own 17 houses while other people starve. That's not what self-preference is. That self-preference literally means that in a situation where my life is on the line, I come first. Okay? So that's a lot of stuff to talk about. And then, to go to your question, ve'avta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, does this verse suggest, assume, demand an obligation to love myself? Now, I'm obviously not going to be able to address all of these questions tonight, right? I really, as I said, this is an ocean in Jewish thought. But I want to at least open up an exploration of some of the key ones and then mention briefly how we might think about some of the other ones. So I want to, if we could, I want to begin by working backwards. Let's think for a minute about the world of academic biblical scholarship for a minute. Because what you'll see here is that no matter where the discourse is, the same essential debate plays out again and again and again. Essentially, it goes like this. Some people say, you can't command emotions. And even if you could, you can't command an emotion that's so totally demanding. Therefore, what love means is actually an action. Act lovingly. And then you have other people who say, that's funny. My impression was that love means love. Why are you doing that? What impulse drives you to translate emotions as actions? Okay? So let's watch this for a minute. Source 3 for a minute. Jay Sklar, contemporary Bible scholar. Love is not first and foremost a feeling, but an action. In this context, such love means a person is to forgive a neighbor's wrongs as quickly as his or her own. More broadly applied, it means a person is to show others the same practical care he or she shows himself or herself. Now, I'm going to use a term that's going to sound insulting. I truly don't mean that. I actually have a fair bit of respect for this person. But there is a constant weaseling among Bible scholars who understand va'ahavta as about actions. They know that that's just not what the word means. So they always end up saying it's not only about emotions. But as soon as you say it's not only about emotions, you realize you have not actually solved your problem at all. Because if it's not only about emotions, it's still also about emotions, and you think emotions can be commanded. As great a biblical scholar as Jacob Milgram, probably the greatest scholar of Vayikra in the history of the world, right, falls into this very trap on this pasuk. How can you be commanded to love, we'll see him say later? Well, you should know love is not only a feeling. Well, that precisely does not answer the question unless you're willing to say love is not a feeling at all. Right? You follow what I just said? Right? Saying it's not only a feeling is not a solution. And by the way, if you say that love is an action, and then you say it means forgiving a neighbor's wrong as quickly as his or her own, forgiveness is not just an action. Try going up to someone who's devastated your life and saying, I'd like to engage in an action right now. I forgive you. See how effective that is, right? So in fact, there's what we call in yeshivish a stira mineuve. This actually doesn't make any sense on its own terms, right? He obviously realizes that on some level, it can't just be an action. Milgram, right, as I just alluded, how can love be commanded? The answer is simply that the verb ahav signifies not only emotion or attitude, but also deeds. I mean, the philosopher in me wants to say, I mean, this is kind of like a non sequitur, right? It just simply doesn't answer the question that it poses. Okay, so then at the other pole, you have emotion. Roy Gain, another contemporary scholar, remarkably, this law controls an internal attitude that is in your heart. After all, what comes before ve'avta l'reacha kamocha, shortly before, we read, lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha, do not hate your brother in your heart. asks the Midrash, maybe it's only about action, Talmud Lomar Bilvavecha. Right? But people still tell me that I make up Judaism's obsession with the emotions. Yeah, only because I wrote the Mechilta. Now, remarkably, this law controls an internal attitude that is in your heart. No human legislative body would dream of formulating such a decree because not even the FBI with the latest surveillance technology can enforce it. Okay, not the greatest way of formulating this point, but fine. The Lord can hold, this is a Christian writer. The Lord can hold people responsible to love rather than hate or covet because God's perception penetrates human thought. In this contrast between love and hatred at the heart of Leviticus 19, the divine legislation reaches behind superficial action to its cognitive and emotional driving forces. It doesn't tell you how the Torah can do that, but it tells you that the Torah does that, right? The Torah is interested in an internal attitude. Just to show you how hard this is, we're not going to read this. In the next paragraph, he then does this very odd thing by saying, love of your neighbor is a principle. Now, when you figure out what he means by the word principle, please raise your hand and I'll stop and give you the floor. Meaning, what does that mean, a principle? Is that an intellectual thing? Is that an emotional thing? Well, what are we talking about exactly? It's a very elusive piece. And then another example of this, source 6, this injunction goes right to the core of the matter and declares that the state of one's heart towards one neighbor is a determining factor in being as holy toward the neighbor as God is holy. What that person is doing is understanding the whole chapter as an analysis of what God means when God says, Kadoshim ti you, you shall be holy, ki kadosh ani, because I am holy, right? So in order to be holy like God, the question is your heart filled with love? Now, from a Jewish perspective, I would say of this evangelical Christian writer, yes, as long as we insist in a good Jewish way that the state of one's heart always has to be expressed also concretely in the world. Which really leads me to the point I want to make about this, which is at the end of the day, it seems to me that the insistent question that all of us tend to ask, is this about emotions or about actions, is in some way a distinctively modern question and misses what I would argue lies as one of the core assumptions of Jewish ethics, which is that the distinction between emotions and actions as a full-on distinction between which one could build a wall is ultimately a false dichotomy. Let me say this in a slightly different way. One of the things we very rarely stop and think about is that our understanding of what emotions are is historically and culturally situated. In the modern world, it is possible for us to say, well, is that a feeling that we're talking about, or is that an action that we're talking about? I am not sure. Now, I am not an intellectual historian, let alone an intellectual historian of the ancient Near East, right? I have a lot of doubts about whether in the biblical world that dichotomy between emotion and action was real at all. That if you had asked people in the biblical world, are you talking about emotions or actions when you talk about love, that they would have said, yeah, that's what we're talking about, right? That kind of like the way in which ultimately a genuine feeling manifests in the world and a true action ultimately tugs upon the heart as well. I think that you find that all over Tanakh and in rabbinic tradition, and that there's something actually distinctively modern about the way we pose the question. I'm happy to try and talk about that more later if people like. So I'll give you an example of the Samuel Ballantyne source 7. A Bible scholar, I think, has this more astutely than anybody else, right? The word love implies both attitude and act. One must not only feel love, but also act in ways that translate love into concrete deeds. That is what a Christian writer writes to a Christian crowd. If I were writing this commentary to a Jewish crowd, I would say, one must not only act in ways that translate love into concrete deeds, but one must also feel love. Right? Because in other words, you always have to battle against the cultural stereotype and the reduction of religion that you are battling against, right? Just as one expresses love for God through active obedience to God's commandments, so too one must demonstrate love for others by reaching out to them with tangible deeds of compassion and concern. And then beautifully, which you don't have the time for here, Ballantyne goes out of his way to say that the word rea, neighbor, fellow, wants to incorporate within it all other members of the people, right? That is to say, even the downtrodden, even the forgotten, even the ones that people tend to forget about. So we see here The temptation to say, okay, love your neighbor as yourself, that's about doing things that translate as loving. Other voices that say, no, that's about a test of the heart. And then Ballantyne, who I honestly think is much more astute, who says, no, that's the ultimate false dichotomy. The aspiration is both, right? The aspiration, at least, is both. That loving my neighbor involves caring about them and acting concretely for their benefit. Now, I want to take this as an opportunity to talk about this in a very concrete way for a minute. Because, as I've said, many people are anxious about the question, can emotions be commanded? How can Roy Gain, who we saw, for example, say that Vayikra is reaching out to make a claim on my internal attitude? The argument is familiar, right? Emotions can't be controlled, so we can't be responsible for them, in which case, they can't be subject to command. As Maimonides says in Sefer Hamadah, it would make no sense, it would render all of Torah incoherent if we were commanded to do things and held morally responsible for things about which we exercise no control. Hence, many conclude, the mitzvah is about things that I do. But is it in fact really true that I can't exercise control over my emotions and that I am thus not responsible for them? So as I hinted earlier, I want to suggest that we have far more control over our feelings, or at least many of them, than we tend to think or than we like to admit. The notion that feelings are beyond our control is so widespread, it is essentially treated as like, you know, pshita mahu detema. Of course that's true in our culture, but I think it's also manifestly false, and I want to show this to you by starting with some intentionally crude examples. Okay? Imagine the following. Your friend rings your doorbell in the evening and says, "Hi, it's so nice to see you. I witnessed an infant bleeding to death on the street on my way here, but I wasn't really affected by it. What can I do? I'm not responsible for my feelings." Or, "I was walking down the street and I witnessed an infant being ripped away from its screaming mother, but I was unaffected. What can I do after all? I'm not responsible for my feelings." I mean, you can't control what you feel. Most likely, most people in this room would react by judging this person negatively. And you would judge them for failing to register an emotionally appropriate response. Horror, compassion, indignation, an urge to help. We would regard their failure to muster such an emotional react as a moral defect. If you don't think you would think that, when we get to the question and answers, I would love to hear it. But I think this is pretty universal. Now consider the converse even more crudely for a minute. Someone shows up at your doorbell, rings your bell, and says, "You know, I just saw someone being beaten to death on the corner. And you know, I found it kind of titillating. What can I do? I can't control how I feel." By the way, you can laugh at that, but like, sadism is a real thing, right? "I just watched an infant being ripped away from its screaming mother, and you know what? It was really enjoyable. I liked thinking about what it would be like to be strong and to have the power to do that to other people. What can I do? I can't control how I feel, and I have fantasies of power. I want to be omnipotent. I like how that feels. It makes me feel like a man. I need gevir," right? We would undoubtedly judge such a person negatively, to put it mildly, for the feelings they had. Now, these are obviously very extreme cases, but what they reveal at minimum is that we don't really believe that people don't bear any responsibility for their emotions. Once I've established that, then we can begin to talk about other kinds of feelings. So if you would, look for a minute at source 8. This has nothing to do, at least on the surface, with Judaism. The American moral philosopher Nancy Sherman writes the following in the beginning of an essay on the philosophy of the emotions. She says, "We often hold people morally responsible for their emotions. We praise individuals for their compassion, think less of them for their ingratitude or hatred, reproach self-righteousness and unjust anger. In the cases I have in mind, the ascriptions of responsibility are not simply for offensive behaviors or actions which may accompany the emotions, but for the emotions themselves as motives or states of mind. We praise and blame people for what they feel and not just for how they act. In cases where people may subtly mask their hatred or ingratitude through more kindly actions, we still may find fault with the attitude we see leaking through the disguise. This reminds me, I wasn't going to talk about this, but this reminds me of a famous argument made by Iris Murdoch, who describes, I hope nobody thinks this example hits too close to home, describes a mother-in-law and her relationship with her daughter-in-law. She says, you know, the mother-in-law X, spends the first years of her son's marriage smiling and being kindly to the daughter-in-law, who she loathes. And over time, she behaves more or less the same way, kindly and gently, only her heart softens and she now genuinely likes and respects this young woman. Murdoch's argument is, we all know that the transformation she has just undergone is morally significant, even though the actions that are manifest in the world have not changed at all. We all have an intuition of the moral significance of a purely, quote unquote, inner life. Now, clearly, not all emotions are the same. Some seem to just happen to us. Others, intuitively, though, seem subject to at least some degree of control. In Sherman's wonderful phrase, we have emotional agency. And I won't get into this here, but she wonderfully argues from the literature on developmental psychology that infants from a very young age are already engaged in learning to regulate and manage their feelings, which is in fact evidence that from a very young age they are already controlling their emotions. And if they're parented well, they are learning to, on some level, control their emotions. To put this differently, and in the language of pretentious philosophy, it is just not true that emotions are passive receptivities, right? That are just things that happen to us. We are, to some degree, also agents in our emotional lives. Now, what does this mean? Because ultimately, we all know, you're not an agent in your emotional life the same way that you're an agent in your physical life. I cannot decide to love you in the same way that I can decide to open the refrigerator, right? There's a difference between those two things. Both of those involve love. But anyway, so in what way do we exercise agency in our emotional lives? So Sherman, like many philosophers who want to make an argument like this, thank you. Sherman appeals to Aristotle, and you find many versions of this in Jewish thought as well, right? And that is this. You cannot simply choose to care about someone at a particular moment in time, but you can indirectly contribute through all kinds of actions and actions you take, habits you developed, to building emotional dispositions, right? You can train yourself to, or prepare yourself to feel in certain ways. Or in the language of the late Rabbi Louis Jacobs, emotions cannot be turned on like a tap, but they can be cultivated. I can engage in the actions that I think a compassionate person would engage in with the conscious hope, I hope this opens my heart, and over time discover that lo and behold, maybe not in a linear way, maybe not in a consistent way, but lo and behold, I am becoming more compassionate. Aristotle thought this is how you acquire virtue. And the Rambam following Aristotle thought exactly the same thing. We train ourselves. It's not automatic. Right? We have to want this. You have to put your heart into it. But we can, in fact, make it more likely that we would feel things. I cannot choose to love you in this moment, but I absolutely can choose to make it more likely that I will come to love you. This is one of the reasons why one of the arguments in America that I find just incredibly frustrating is you can't choose who you love. That's just a strange argument. I'm not talking here about sexual orientation, right? But this notion that, like, I mean, there's all kinds of actions we take to make some situations more likely than others, right? There are all kinds of ways in which we actually set the path which we later take. So emotional agency doesn't mean, oh, love your neighbor as yourself. I'm walking down the street, I see Jonathan Malamy, and I think, I never saw you before in my life, but I love you, right? But I may be able, he's sitting right there. You can all acknowledge him. Yeah. But I can, and according to these sources, I think ought to, prepare myself such that that is more likely to be my reaction. I might call that indirect willing of emotions as opposed to direct willing of emotions. Is that clear what I mean by that? Okay. I give you an example of this from Musar literature in the 20th century. But Eliyahu Dessler, one of the great lines in his writing, it's like so simple. He says, you know, people often come to me and say, I don't want to give to this person because I don't love them. And I always say the same thing, right? If you want to love them, why don't you start by giving to them? You have this exactly backwards, right? You have an opportunity to train yourself in the art of love. Take that opportunity, okay? Okay, now, let's enter the history of Jewish thought for a minute and ask, how have Jewish sources heard this mandate? So first, we find the same debates. Doubts that emotions can be commanded. Again, I think that's an unconvincing approach. And then more explicitly, how can I be commanded to love my neighbor quite this much? Isn't this, in the language of many modern rabbinic figures, neged hateva? Isn't this against what human nature is capable of? But even if it were possible, would it be desirable? And look for a minute, if you would, at source 9. This source comes up over and over and over and then over again in the literature on love your neighbor as yourself. Shnayim shayu malchin baderech. Two people were walking on the way. It's a very well-known Talmudic story. Uveyad echad mehen kiton shalmayim. In the hand of one of them was a jug of water. Im shotim shneyem, if they both drink, meitim, they will both die. V'im shote echad mehen, magil yishuv. And if only one of them drinks, that person will survive. Darash ben Petura says, mutaf shiyishu shneyem b'yamutu, v'al yireh echad mehen b'mitato shel chaviro. It is best that they both drink and die, and let neither of them witness the death of the other one. Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva, Ad sheba here I think is important because it suggests comes Rabbi Akiva and wins this debate. Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva, until Rabbi Akiva comes and says, V'limeid v'chai achicha imach, that your brother may live with you. You are first. Chayecha kodmin l'chaye chavercha. Your life comes first. So in other words, many halachic thinkers especially want to say, right? If it's really true that I'm obligated to love my neighbor as much as I love myself, well then, how can it be that I'm told that I should save my life and not his? I want to be honest and say that even though this argument is all over halachic literature, it has never struck me as a very good argument. That is to say, there are all kinds of things you could say here, like, this only applies to an instance where your life is on the line. This is not that pikuach nefesh might be its own issue, right? That it isn't clear to me necessarily that you want to learn from this case by establishing it as a paradigm for all instances of there's limited resources and what do I do? You could make an argument for why you would want to read it that way, but it isn't clear to me that that's the only possible understanding of the halachic implications of this passage. Be that as it may, okay? Now, I'm going to do this in a much briefer way than I planned. So again, what do people who genuinely think you can't command emotions tend to say? Oh, it must be that love refers to action. And you have two strands in the history of Jewish thought. One strand we can call the minimalist strand. What does love your neighbor as yourself mean? Do not do to others what you don't want them to do to you. Right? This, fascinatingly, goes back very far in rabbinic literature. The assumption that ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, is equivalent to the famous statement attributed to Hillel in Masechet Shabbat, right? When asked, right, to teach the whole Torah while standing on one foot, what does Hillel famously say, right? That which is hateful to you, do not do to anybody else. That's source 10. Now, what I provided for you is all kinds of sources from all kinds of periods that simply assume these two things are synonymous. Now, you would not necessarily assume that. If I said to you, don't do unto others what you don't want them to do to you, and love your neighbor as yourself, are those exactly the same thing? My guess is you would say no, right? But they end up becoming the same thing out of an anxiety around this story of Rabbi Akiva and Ben Petura, right? I obviously can't be asked to love my neighbor as myself, but what can I plausibly be asked? Don't do to your neighbor what you yourself wouldn't want done to you. So you can look, for example, just to Targum Yonatan, which in a scholarly aside, I will tell you, nobody has any idea really how to date this. It is assigned to a man named Yonatan ben Uziel, who was a student of Hillel's, but there is no way that he actually wrote it. He translates this verse. If you look in the middle of the verse, if you can read Aramaic, or after the semicolon if you're reading English, v'terachme l'chaverech, rachamim in Aramaic means love, not mercy. Deman antsane lach lo tavid le. Right? This is his translation, as it were, of love your neighbor as yourself. That which you hate, don't do to him. Okay? And then, if you're interested in this, you can look at two well-known commentaries on the Talmud, the Maharsha and the Maharatz Chayot, who simply say on this sugya in Masechet Shabbat, oh, what is Hillel saying? He's explaining what love your neighbor as yourself means. And what's the proof that that's what he must be doing? After all, don't you know what Rabbi Akiva said to Ben Petura? Right? This thing is so embedded that I thought I'd show you something cool. If you look at source 14, Avot Rabbi Natan, a late rabbinic midrash, I'll read it in English. Listen to this. It happened that someone came to Rabbi Akiva and said to him, my master, teach me the entirety of Torah as a unified whole. And Akiva replied, my son, if Moses, our teacher, peace be upon him, spent 40 days and 40 nights on the mountain until he learned it, how can you ask me to teach you the entirety of Torah in one unified whole? Rather, my son, this is the principle of Torah. What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. If you do not want someone to harm you, do not harm him. If you do not want someone to take what is yours, do not take what is his. Here, Hillel and Rabbi Akiva have been morphed into each other. Right? It's not just that they said the same thing. The story of what happened to Hillel, in fact, happened to Rabbi Akiva. That's what happens when an interpretation is so deeply embedded that you end up thinking, right, they end up being conflated altogether. Now, some people say, look, I understand that maybe commanding emotions is problematic, so let's talk about actions. But why would you limit it to what you shouldn't do? Don't the words love your neighbor as yourself seem more ambitious? By the way, the world would be a better place if we never did to anyone what we wouldn't want done to us, right? I mean, I wouldn't take that lightly, right? But might we not want to be more ambitious in interpreting a positive formulation of the verse? Rambam, source 15. Mitzvat aseh shel divrehem. It is a mitzvah, a positive mitzvah of rabbinic level. Levaker cholim, to visit the sick. Lenachem avelim, to comfort the mourners. Lehotzi ameit, to bury the dead, etc. And he says, the last four lines in the Hebrew, and then you can find it in the English. He says, Afal pi shekol mitzvot elu midivrehem. Even though these mitzvot technically have a status of being rabbinic, harehen bichlal ve'avtal areacha kamocha. They are part of love your neighbor as yourself. Kol hadvarim shata rotze shiasu otam lecha achirim, that last phrase I'm not going to talk about tonight. Talk about it next week. But in other words, this is the opposite. Not that which you wouldn't want done for you, don't do to someone else, but everything that you would want done for you, you should do for other people. To which the obvious question that will emerge in the history of halacha is, everything? I want you to give me $1 million. I want you to give me your, I don't know, I've just hit the age of appropriate midlife crisis. I want your red Alfa Romeo. Give it to me. Raise your hand if you can imagine me driving a red Alfa Romeo. Okay. I'm flattered. So that's a more ambitious claim. You would want someone to visit you. Visit them. You would want someone to comfort you. Comfort them. Oh, but isn't that true about everything? Comes one of the most beautiful, I think, commentaries in the history of Parshanut, of commentary on this verse, Haktava Kabbalah Reyakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, great biblical commentary of the 18th and 19th century, and essentially says the following, which, given the hour, I'm not going to read in any depth. He says, essentially, do all the things that you would be offended or troubled if someone didn't do for you. No one would say, if you don't give me your car, I'll never forgive you. I mean, maybe they would say that, but they have a personality disorder and you would get them help, right? But they might say, if you don't come visit me when I'm miserable, right? That, you know, you have to do. And he does this thing that I think is emotionally very, very moving. He gives you this list. You can look, you know, in the second section. She'ohavoto be'emet velo b'ziyuf. I want my neighbor to love me in truth and not fraudulently. She'itnaheg b'kavod tamid. He should treat me with respect always. She'idrosh shlomi tamid. He should seek my well-being, because that's what people who care about each other do. She'ishtatef b'tzari, that he'll share in my sorrow. She'kabel oti b'sever panim yafot k'shavo lebeito. When I come into his house, he won't be like, oh God, right? But actually say, welcome, right? Etc., etc. Okay? Now, and then he says, but if I wouldn't think, oh, I have a right to expect this of you, then I'm not obligated to do it for you, right? I would never conclude, oh, you have to like empty out your bank account and give it to me. I might conclude, if I'm starving, you have to feed me. I might even conclude, he says, that if my business is falling apart and you can afford it, you have to save it. But I wouldn't conclude you have to give me everything you have. Therefore, obviously, I don't have to do it. And then he says, and I think this is a great moment, Parshanun, he says, and therefore, all these people who are so worked up about the word kamocha should get a grip. Kamocha simply means, right, that which you yourself would think is obviously what you're entitled to is what you yourself are obligated to. Love your neighbor in a way that suggests mutuality. Now, it is now 8:30. I am basically out of time as I'm concluding part one of seven, talking about missing your time on a probation. But I want to make the following observation, which is either going to strike you as totally obvious, or that's interesting. And I want to say, I'm not sure whether this is obviously right or preposterously wrong, but I want to share this because it actually only occurred to me in the last couple days, which is that there is something really striking, as you already can see here, in the difference that between how Jews understand this verse traditionally and how Christians do. That is to say that Christians often understand love your neighbor as yourself as primarily about your relationship with everyone. And the history of Parshanut, the history of Jewish Bible commentary, as far as I understand it, tends to focus its interpretation on love your neighbor as yourself much more on your relationship with people you know. Family, friends, community members. There may be other laws that refer to everyone, or you might even say that this, taken to its logical conclusion, includes everyone or all Jews, back to that question I raised earlier. But it is really striking to me, and I'm kind of embarrassed to say that it took me all these years for this finally to hit me, how different the point of emphasis is. Now, here's the thing about American Jews. They live in America, which means they live in a country whose culture is Christian. And so their impulse is always to say, well, universalism is always better than particularism. Except, as I have said in this space many times, that is an extremely kind of unworked out thought. Because often in the history of the world, universalism goes hand in hand with imperialism, right? Since everyone is included, I will now tell you what to do. That is why the history of Christian universalism has had taken thousands of years to leave anybody alone, right? Now, Judaism, in contrast, has taken all the risks of particularism. On the one hand, the great benefit is, I don't really have any need to convert you and to force you to live like me. But on the other hand, my constant Yetzer Hara is to forget that you matter at all. That is the great Yetzer Hara in the Jewish tradition, right? God loves Jews, and as for other people, they're kind of like a backdrop for the only thing that really matters. What I'm saying here is I think it's actually important to keep in mind the ways in which, rather than thinking about universalism good, particularism bad, that is an ugly part of our kind of, I would say, self-hating Pauline heritage, right? Is to ask, what are the costs and consequences of either path you choose? right? The danger of talking about everyone is that you end up talking about no one in particular. The danger of talking about your friends is you develop no sense of social responsibility at all. After all, what do? I take care of other people who are upper middle class. Because that's who I see at shul. Because after all, anyone who's poor can't afford to come. Right? I'm really not trying to be flippant. I want to I think what's important to do here is not immediately to jump to which do I prefer, but to think about what is at stake in each path that you might take. Now, this is, I think, part of Judaism's, you could say. In other words, here's what I'm trying to say, I think, is that the different impulses in interpreting these verses are a manifestation of a larger disagreement about primary impulse. Is the primary impulse caring about those I'm close to and then ultimately expanding outward? Or is the primary impulse caring about everyone and folding the people I'm close to into that? If you're confident that one of those is so clearly a better answer, you're ahead of me. Honestly, I mean, and I'm not saying that in a flip or rhetorical way, right? So I think this may be a manifestation of that very issue. Now, I'm going to take just a couple of more minutes. I'm going to skip the entirety of what I wanted to talk about what it might mean to have Klal Gadol Batorah and the debate, and just ask you to turn to the very last source, I think it is, for just a moment. Rabbi Elimelech Bar Shaul. If you've never heard of him, you're in good company. He was the chief rabbi of Rehovot for a long time. And he wrote a book called Mitzvah Valev, Commandment and Heart, which is about what are the mitzvot that apply to the human heart. And he says this thing that is totally magnificent and simple. He says, what does Rabbi Akiva mean when he says, love your neighbor as yourself is the great principle of Torah? So here's what happens in religions and moral systems. People have a great insight or dream. And then they go about translating a set of concrete implications of that great picture or dream. And then they go about forgetting what the practices were intended to accomplish in the first place. And he says, this is a rather bold statement, this is essentially the history of halakha. The history of halakha, ben adam l'chaveiro, he says, right, interpersonal relations, is about how do I implement and play out the aspiration to truly love my neighbor? Well, let me tell you 46 things I should do that will both reflect and elicit the commitment to loving the neighbor. And then what happens? Right? Well, he says, you lose sight of what you're into it for because at the end of the days, the trees become more interesting than the forest. So he says, what is Rabbi Akiva saying? You gotta really work on this. Because ultimately, Hilchot Ben Adam L'Chaveiro are about instilling love, or they're not really about anything at all. And so Klal Gadol is a way of saying, let us remember what this is for. The danger, you know, let me put it in this way. Rabbinic tradition took an enormous gamble in becoming a legal culture. You know, there's two cliches in our culture. One is that God is in the details, and the other is that the devil is in the details. And the truth is, they are both right. Right? Because when done right, what Hilchot Ben Adam L'Chaveiro can do is cultivate an exquisite attentiveness to the needs of the other person in front of me. And what it can do when I'm not attentive, right, is like generate 70,000 tshuvas about whether I'm yotze if I do this or I do that, right? And you have the sense that the person talking may sometimes have lost what they're trying to do because the trees have crowded out the forest. So Elimelech Bar Shaul says, Rabbi Akiva basically comes along to say, look, guys, interpersonal relationships are about a playing out of love. That's what it is. And I'm warning you, do not forget this, or it will ultimately be not about anything. What could be worse than being a legal formalist about Ben Adam L'Chaveiro? What do I have to do for the person in the hospital? Say a svara, right? Those of you who went to yeshiva, right? And like at the end of the day, we're talking about categories as opposed to a person lying in a hospital, right? So says Eliyahu Melech Bar Shaul, Klal Gadol Batorah Ve'Avtal Recha Kamocha. This is about the love you feel for this person who's suffering. Now, he's not saying, therefore forget about law. He's saying there's a kind of dialectic between a set of legal commitments and the value that they are an attempt to instantiate. And I, by the way, I think he would say rather polemically, if that sounds like a great innovative chiddush, if that sounds like an innovation, that is only a testimony to the failure of the project. Because that should be obvious, right? Law is an implementation of a certain vision of the world. Okay. I am going to say one final thing and then stop and take questions or thoughts, and maybe if you feed me, I'll be able to give the other 70% of what I wanted to say. What does it mean if we believe that the emotions are called for? As I said at the outset, I'm obviously not commanded to love my neighbor in the same way that I'm loving my spouse or loving my child. Now, we didn't get a chance to see this, but the Sefer HaChinuch beautifully says, well, the primary meaning is, I really don't want anything bad to happen to you. I want to protect you. But also, I want to do nice things for you. But the primary meaning is, I don't want anything bad to happen to you. There are other voices, but Ramban, who is extraordinarily beautiful about this, Nachmanides basically says, it's amazing, everything that I want for myself, I should want you to have too, and not by being a little bit of a guy who says, I want you to have it too, but just a little less than me. I genuinely want the good for you. I want to be regarded as successful. I want you to be regarded as successful. I want to live comfortably. There's a difference between succeeding and competing. And by the way, it's beautiful. How does Ramban get this? By saying, Ve'avta l'recha kamocha, you should love for your neighbor the same things you love for yourself. Right? Shmuel Golden, who was the rabbi in the modern Orthodox Shul in Teaneck for a long time, wonderfully observes about the Ramban here. The Ramban takes the mitzvah away from the impossible and embraces instead the extraordinarily difficult. Right? I mean, this is still rather emotionally demanding, right? And it is deeply emotional, right? Imagine the generosity of spirit it takes to overcome jealousy and competitiveness. Now, what I want to propose, and here this is really, I'd be really curious, some of you who are inside of this literature more than I am, I have come to think in the last few months that a particular development in a field of philosophy called care ethics may be a really good way of thinking about what it means to have to love my neighbor. When Nell Noddings, famously in 1984, I believe it is, published her book Caring, which was one of the two defining texts of the feminist care ethics movement, that together with Carol Gilligan's In a Different Voice. So Nell Noddings basically emphasized that the primary ethical moment was in caring for another person. In her language, being engrossed by their needs. It was not following rules a la Kant. It's not a great reading of Kant, but okay, it's the standard reading of Kant. It's not following rules. It's actually about the person in front of me and my obligations to her. Right? That is the primary ethical moment. Over time, many people came along and said, you know, Professor Noddings, that is extremely moving and powerful. It is also the moral philosophy of a very privileged person. Because you're basically saying that people who live in the Hamptons, their primary moral obligations in the world are to take care of other people who live in the Hamptons. And what about the people who live in Ghana? I mean, care ethics is great in pointing to the reality and the centrality of the relationship in front of me. But what about everybody else? Because after all, how many people can you possibly care for in that way? This is too particularistic. So 18 years later, Nell Noddings publishes another book in which she says, I think I got it now. Okay? The primary moral relationship is caring for. But there is also something else called caring about. And caring about consists of enabling other people to be cared for. So my obligations towards someone I've never met in Ghana are essentially about, are caring about them rather than directly caring for them, which I can't do. But the caring about them makes a dramatic claim, and what it's about is enabling the possibility of other people to be cared for also. Now, there's a lot you could say about this, there's a lot of critiques of this. What interests me about this is when we try to find the language of what it means to love other people that we don't know, about which it is easy to become cynical, right? I wonder whether this kind of language of caring about might be important and actually helpful to us in thinking about that. What does it mean to cultivate caring about? I may not be the person who visits every last person in this room in the hospital, but I may try to live my life in such a way that ensures that that person will be visited. And then obviously beyond this room into other tax brackets and other countries and other continents. And in other words, what I'm trying to do here is to propose some kind of emotional meaning. Since I actually think the Bible is here making a claim on the emotions, what kind of emotion might it be claiming? And the very tentative, tenuous, apologetic proposal I'm making for now is that it is asking for us to cultivate the capacity for caring for who's local and for caring about who's less local. And that ultimately the circle of caring about expands. I'm going to stop here and take questions, comments, thoughts. Okay, thoughts. I'll talk to them in groups of three.
How about washing out emotion and just using the word like, which is, after all, a proper definition of all have, or alternatively, compassion and empathy, which might also be another way of saying love.
Okay, great. I will repeat these questions as I answer them. Okay, other people, yeah, please.
I was wondering about what you thought about the end of the verse, the Ani Hashem bit, and how you see it being one or something, facts and moral facts, but generally how it plays into our understanding of caring about it.
Weren't you listening to the part I didn't get to? Yeah, great. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, Ben, yeah.
Similarly, what about the rest of the verse? What about vengeance, rebuke, all these other things that are mentioned, that the whole context here, and like, is that illustrative of what?
Great. Okay, great. So first, the question is, why not talking about liking rather than loving? I think the answer is more radical than your question suggests, which is that the obligation is to love even people that I don't like. That's actually the point. Whether I like you, my liking you or not, does not give me a tour from loving you. By the way, you want to talk about spiritual practice? That right there is a spiritual practice. How do I love people I don't particularly like? Many of you practice this on holidays. I'm not trying to be flip. No, I mean this really seriously, right? Ask any rabbi what he or she spends their time on when people come to visit them before, I don't know, winter break or Thanksgiving. It's some version of that. I'm not trying to be flip. I'm really being serious. Meaning, that's why I don't think like is a good solution here, because I think the claim is more radical. What you locally might feel about me and my behavior is not what's being spoken about here. Or some, right? I hope it's good what I'm going for. Now, compassion and empathy, I think in Jewish thought, are manifestations of love and close cousins of it. I'm not sure they're exactly synonymous with it. Although, Avital, I've been wondering this today. Do you say compassion in Aramaic also is rachamim? In Aramaic, the word for love and compassion is the same word, correct? Which is really interesting, right? Hebrew doesn't do that, right? Rachamim and ahava are different words. In Aramaic, they're both racham. Hence, those of you who like Talmud, the great name of the rabbi in Masechet Ketubot, Rav Rechume, whose name is Rabbi Love, who dies because of his failure to live a life of love with his family. Now, Ani Hashem. So, there are many things this might mean. I want to share with you only one comment. This is love. Bechor Shor commentary in the late 13th, 14th century. I'm within 200 years. Bechor Shor says something amazing on the phrase Ani Hashem in this verse. He says, "Let your love for me outweigh your dislike of him." Presumably, you're living in a context where the mitzvah is loving me. Love me more than you dislike any other person. And that way you'll know you can't act on your dislike of them. Now, I think there are many other ways to read this. That may be a homiletical interpretation, but it is gorgeous and powerful, right? Because it relates to something that some of you have heard me say ad nauseum, right? The aspiration is to become more like a God who loves expansively than to cut God down to the size of you who loves much less expansively, which is what most of us end up doing in our theologies, right? God hates the same people I do, as opposed to how do I learn to love, right, the way that God loves a much more expansive group of people. I mean, God loves people I don't like. And I say I love God, and God says, okay, but that's my kid. Right? The example of this, by the way, I'm not making it up. The Maharal, for example, in the 16th century, talks about this at some length. You know, you go up to someone, you've heard, many of you have heard me say this, but you go up to someone and you say, you know, I really love you. Your kids make me ill. Right? The fact is, almost everyone in the world would react with, I don't know if I want your love. What do you mean? Maharal says, that's God's relationship to Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. I mean, you love me, but you hate my kids? Why don't you leave? Right? So that's part of the Ani Hashem piece. Now, as for the psukim, yes. So let me say a couple of things about the verses. First of all, Lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha, I think establishes that the primary issue here is the emotions. Okay? And then, beautifully, by the way, it gives you, it seems to me, a concrete practice by which to nurture not hating. That is, by talking, right? The way to undo the impulse to hate people is by talking to them about what's happened between you. And then lo tikom velo titor, which means something else in rabbinic literature, I suspect means do not either act vengeantly or harbor those feelings in your heart. This is one of the reasons why I'm convinced that these verses are about emotion and action in an integrated way. I would also say, this is one of the two main topics I didn't get to, that the pshat of this verse, it has always been completely clear to me. There are people who disagree with me. I really think they're wrong. That the pshat of this verse is that re'acha means other members of the covenant. I mean, all the other terms clearly refer to members of the covenant. Achicha, amitecha, etc. Now, to be clear, the mandate to love members of the covenant does not equal be utterly indifferent to the fate of or hate other people, right? This goes back to the issue of, okay, I'm going to say this in a ridiculous way. Unless you are one of the 12 people in the world who is truly a Peter Singerian utilitarian, where actual no relationships actually have any weight at all, I have no more obligations to my own child than I have to the child halfway around the world. This is called utilitarianism gone mad, right? Unless you have that view, you recognize that on some level, my being embodied and in space and time means that I have certain obligations that are different, right? If I see you drowning in front of me or I hear about a child drowning 6,000 miles away, my level of moral obligation is not the same in those two instances. That is a basic moral intuition about having a body and being located in space and time. Now, by the way, I just made a hugely polemical claim that not everyone agrees with, but I can take the microphone afterwards. I have no idea why I just started saying this. What was I saying this in response to? Oh, yes, right, okay. So I can say I am obligated to love certain people, but I am obligated to respect everybody. Or you can say, since many liberal Jews have stereotypes, Rav Shlomo Schneider, Haredi Rav in Monticello, New York, died 1995, and his Shelot U'Tshuvot, in his responsa, Divrei Shlomo, says, there's two kinds of love. There's the love I owe every human being because they are Tzelem Elohim. And then there's the love I owe a family and a covenant. And just as I might owe my wife more love than I owe the neighbor across the street, even though I owe the neighbor across the street love, so also the relationship I have with Jews and with other people. Now, here's the funny thing. We in America, in this moment, have a very hard time with this. And it's not because, this is something that my colleague Ethan Tucker pointed out to me a few years ago in a really insightful way. I know that's shocking. It's not that American Jews are not comfortable with particularity. It's that they have come to center in their lives a different particularity than they have historically. That is, they feel more of a sense of particular obligation to the other people who live on their block, as opposed to the Jew who lives halfway around the world. But nobody really feels uncomfortable with particularity unless they have tenure in philosophy and teach utilitarianism of a particularly blunt kind. Everybody realizes there are other obligations that are primary. So in other words, I think it's clear here that the obligation of this verse is to love your fellow covenant member. But you should not deduce from that, and therefore Judaism hates everybody else. I will also mention one other thing here that I think is amazing, is that the Rambam, one of the great innovations in the Rambam's halakha, is that he argues the following without ever saying it, but I think it's pretty clear. When you develop virtue, when you develop a loving character, as opposed to merely a commitment to doing concrete loving things, then virtue overcomes all boundaries. Kidichtiv, as Tehillim says, I think you could say the Rambam's favorite verse about ethics, Tov Adonai Lakol V'Rachamav Al Kol Ma'asav, God is good to all and God's mercy is upon all creations. If the Rambam could, in his Tanakh, he would have underlined the words kol 50,000 times. When you become like God, what lifni mishurat hadin, going beyond the letter of the law, means in the Rambam is not halachic punctiliousness. It means that all the norms that apply to my relationship with Jews apply to my relationship with all human beings. Because virtue sees no boundaries. Virtue sees only human beings. So love your neighbor as yourself, as boundaried, is only the first step. That's the law. But the virtuous person goes beyond the law by being a being of love. And a being of love does not stop and say, you're 3/5 human. That's definitional to what virtue is. So what you see is, on the one hand, this kind of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha becomes the pole, the sort of the one pole that kind of is limited and particular. But then there's the other pole that says, and of course I transcend that ultimately, because I become virtuous and want to be like God. And God, after all, is the God of creation, not just covenant. So if the God of creation is the God of creation, creation in a certain sense overrides the boundaries created by covenant in ethics. That's an amazing chiddush in the Rambam. And as always in the Rambam, he points no attention to it. He just does it. Yeah, please.
So whether it's that line in the Rambam, or in the Aramaic, love and forgiveness overlapping, or in the first...
love and compassion, yeah.
Where it's, you shall not vengeance, but love your neighbor, not
right.
But one might presume, forgiveness. And then, so we're in that thought space, we're overlapping these terms, and then we consider the funny example you gave about the mother-in-law and her daughter-in-law.
It's not my example.
Oh, okay. Whereas the actions can trump or transform the emotion. My question then is, why does Moses not forgive himself for hitting the rock? Because in that moment, he begs Hashem for forgiveness. And like the verse before is learning the 13 attributes of mercy. You just learned these 13 attributes of mercy of God. So of course God could forgive Moses. So it must be that Moses can't forgive himself. And is it that Moses understands that he failed at the action, he hit the rock, therefore he can never achieve the emotion, loving Israel?
Okay, so I want to try to, if I could, not get sort of sucked into an analysis of one particular moment in Tanakh. I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards. Why doesn't Moshe forgive himself? At the end of the day, that strikes me as, now this is not a way of dismissing it, that's a deeply non-biblical question. Because in the Bible, the primary goal of forgiveness is to have God forgive you. I think, honestly, for the Tanakh itself, the question that it wants you to wrestle with is, why does the God, who is the God of chesed and forgiveness, find this particular crime unforgivable? And this is an example of what literary critics might call a readerly story, right? It is not obvious at all what the answer to that question is. That is one of the stories in Tanakh that I believe is meant to bring you up short and leave you scratching your head and wondering what on earth is going on here, and thereby to be lured into a conversation about the limits of divine forgiveness and the qualifications for leadership and the emotional qualifications for leadership. In other words, I think it's a more complicated picture than that. Later Jewish sources, and this relates to your question from a long time ago, will talk about things like self-forgiveness. But that's a later Jewish discussion. What I think, for what it's worth, in Vayikra is that self-love is an assumption, not an obligation. The Bible assumes that a person loves him or herself and wants him or her to learn from that what it might mean to love other people. Later Jewish sources, you find this especially in Musar, will talk about the necessity of valuing yourself and loving yourself, without which you can't really accomplish anything. Rabbeinu Yerucham Levovitz, who was a great Musar teacher in the 20th century, it's just an amazing thing. He says, you know, people start doing Musar. And this, I'm not talking here about like Musar in America, but like people start doing Musar in East European yeshiva. And what happens is that they end up thinking that the goal of Musar is to identify 736 things that are profoundly wrong with them and then dwell there, right? And he says, you know, but here's the thing. Musar as a project is destined to utter failure and futility unless the first thing I internalize is I am infinitely valuable and God cares about me. He says, there is no personal growth without that. Otherwise, all you're doing is just deepening your self-hatred and your inability to do anything constructive in the world. That's already coming close to the language you're talking about. Very few rabbinic sources will talk about this, the mitzvah to love yourself, because as you may know, in the history of philosophy, the term self-love is very loaded. It is considered, the language is sometimes used as a virtue and sometimes used to describe a vice of being narcissistic and caring only about myself. When someone talks about self-love, the first thing you have to ask is, what are we talking about here? They're not always talking about what you're talking about, which is the positive kind of self-love that believes, you know, I'm valuable, I'm not a shmate, I'm not worthless. And in Musar, you find that very, very clearly developed as like a value. In Tanakh, I think it's an assumption. It may not be, you might want to say it's not a great assumption. We could talk, you know, we could struggle with that. But I think it is pretty much an assumption. Let me take a round of three more questions and then I'll try to answer them relatively briefly and go on. John, go ahead. No, go ahead. You can go first. And then I'll take one from this side. Sorry. I'm trying to move a little bit to the right in light of what's happening here. Yeah. Believe me. I'm there.
You might believe in terms of that the exegesis is really found in the Hebrew itself. And that it falls to what Rabbi Elimelech says about ordering oneself towards relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And what Rabbi Heschel would say, that ultimately humans want to be known. That even in prayer, mm-hmm. making ourselves known in the mind of Hashem. And therefore, love itself is an estimation of knowing, not simply being emotionally connected to, but emotionally aware of, or knowing someone. And that if you see it that way, that in the Hebrew itself, the vav serves as a vav ha'ipuch, which changes it from a perfect tense of you loved to an imperfect tense of you will love.
Or you shall love, yeah.
You shall love, which establishes a continuous state, as opposed to something like to hate, which is something which is a perfected state that we hate someone and that's the end of it. Or we know someone and we continue in that state, or we know someone and that's the end of it. So you'll continue to know them just as you want to be known. That the kamocha is really a moment of that only humans want to be known by each other and by God. And that part of loving someone is being emotionally aware of their good.
Okay.
And ordering yourself to that.
Great. So I'm gonna respond to that in just a moment. Jonathan?
Spent time at the beginning talking about, you know, is it emotion or is it action or is it emotion and action? And though this may be a modern construct, right, because you said that maybe differentiating those is a modern idea anyway, the piece that's missing for me usually in that trio is thought, right? How does thinking mediate between feelings and actions? And that goes to the larger question that you posed too about how do we direct our emotions. And, you know, if babies are
right,
because they're conditioned, it's different when you become conscious of the desire to do it.
So I want to, let me take that. I can't even read the notes I'm taking here. So great. Yeah, please. You.
I guess somewhat related, although not intentionally, to John's question, what's the role of seeing and hearing? are they implicit in the notion of love? I'm struggling with how you can love someone in any meaningful way without hearing them, without seeing them. That's obviously different than, you know, in a relationship that's up close versus one that's farther away.
Okay.
Even here, crying in the distance.
Okay, so by the way, the two comments, that the first and the third comment, are deeply intertwined with one another, I think. Let me try to take these for a minute. I'm going to start with Jonathan's because I think it's in its own category. So I am completely out of my depth here, having zero training in ancient Near Eastern anything, other than, you know, trying to learn Tanakh. I am not sure that the distinction between thinking and feeling either fully applies in the ancient Near East. After all, the word lev means heart and mind. And you'll see people in Bible scholarship do this too. They'll say, no, the heart is the seat of thinking. No, the heart is the seat of feeling. I always feel like, you know, when you start doing that, you're probably revealing something about your culture, but not the culture you're talking about. The heart is the seat of both of those things, and those things are deeply entwined. And by the way, volition also. Wanting something for someone. By the way, intuitively for me, that's totally indistinguishable from emotions. Genuinely wanting something for someone is not merely volitional. The volitions are emotional, right? I think, by the way, that Roy Gain, who we read at the beginning, may be gesturing towards that when he talks about an inner attitude. I suspect, though I obviously don't know this, that by attitude he means to incorporate both thinking and feeling. So I'm supposed to think a certain way about my neighbor and feel a certain way about her as well. Now, by the way, the fact that the Bible doesn't make these distinctions doesn't mean that these distinctions are not helpful. But we just ought to be careful to understand what the Bible itself might be up to. Now, regarding loving as knowing. So I just finished writing an absurdly long chapter on the book of Ruth. And I think it's worth mentioning a very particular moment that is, I think, the biblical illustration of what you're kind of pointing towards. As you know, if the book of Ruth is fresh in your mind, when Ruth, in chapter 1, verse 16 and 17, takes her famous declaration, right? I'm with you forever and ever, right? The response she gets from Naomi is nothing at all. And there are all kinds of different interpretations of that. The one I actually think is most powerful and insightful was first put forward by Judith Cates, who some of you may know, that the problem that Naomi has is that she is so depressed and desolate that she's unreachable. It doesn't matter how much love is shown to her, she can't. But now imagine you're Ruth for a minute. You've just declared your love for someone, nothing. Then you arrive in Beit Lechem, and the women all say, Hazot Naomi, can this be what Naomi looks like? And Naomi says, I have returned empty. Neither the women of Bethlehem nor Naomi herself acknowledge that Ruth is even standing there, right? And then Boaz says to Ruth, right, Hagid hu godly, let me tell you, I have heard and I have heard again about all of the kindness you have done and all the risks you have taken and all that you have given up out of love for Naomi. And what does Ruth thank him for? The kindness you have shown me, lahakireni. Which, by the way, is a magnificent pun on what she just said, v'anochi nochriya. Right, lahakir nochriya. I am an outsider, I am not, and yet you have seen me. And she literally throws herself at his feet. She goes, oh my God, you saw me. You know something about, I am registering as a person. The other biblical example of this, by the way, that is astonishing is the story of Hagar, where Abraham and Sarah never refer to her by name. They always refer to her only as the Shifcha. And then the angel appears to Hagar. And what's the first word the angel says to Hagar? Hagar, you have a name. You are a human being. I see you. And what does she call God? Ata El Roi. You are the God who sees me, right? You are the God who sees me. The only character in Tanakh who gives God a name in that way. By the way, Hagar is a hero in womanist theology, that is, black feminist theology, precisely because this amazing claim that the one person in Tanakh who is seen by God in such a way as to name God is most likely a black woman. After all, she's Egyptian. It's only because of the cultural construction of American Jewish yeshivas that you imagine Hagar as a white person. She's Egyptian. I'm actually being really serious here, meaning she's a major figure in womanist theology for this reason. Now, this is where your comment, right, and yours are totally interwoven. Now, what I think Jewish ethics would say about this is seeing and hearing enables a kind of caring for. But it might still be possible to care about people you don't know. I can tell you a story about a child who's just been ripped from his mother's arms. You've never seen that child, you've never heard that child, but my simply evoking that child elicits from you caring about them, even though you might not be able to care for them. You might not be able to reach them, right? So I'm not sure that caring about, which is another one of the reasons I'm sort of drawn to this image of caring about, necessitates that. Because let's put it this way. If caring depends on seeing and hearing, then by definition, we're not capable of ever moving beyond the local. I mean, I can go somewhere far away, but then that's the local for me in that moment. But what about the person who's on the other edge of the world and always will be? What about the person I will never see? Unless there is some form of caring that becomes possible without direct sensory interaction, we've limited ourselves. So that's why I find this nodding's imagery helpful, even if I may be spinning it in my own way, that there's some way in which I can still expand who I feel connected to, responsible for, without directly seeing them. Now, if all I have is caring about without caring for, that's really problematic. I mean, look, I'll end with this. One of the things I said to the students in a summer program at Yeshivat Hadar, the first summer we started visiting Alzheimer's patients, and I got a lot of pushback on this, and I am ending, Tali, I'm sorry. I said to a group of them, I said, look, a lot of you are very impassioned social justice activists. You care a lot about the world, and I could not admire that more. But you know, I think it's really important to cultivate the ability to just sit with a person who's suffering and just be there. And some of them were like, no, that's Band-Aids. I'm like, it's not Band-Aids. Stop with the rhetoric. It's not Band-Aids. It's actually someone is lonely and you're sitting there and you are gonna be confronted with your own powerlessness and you're gonna sit there, right? You're gonna just sit there and realize that the only power you have in this moment is to be there. Right? That's it. And you know what? You will also discover, I hope, that that is a lot. And that many people go through all of their life not knowing how to do that ever. And many people go through life not having anyone do that for them ever. Many people have marriages where that never happens. I mean, imagine that. And so there's something about, if you care about without learning to care for, that caring about becomes abstract. And frankly, you become, I think, deeply rigid and self-righteous. Like, there's some way in which, in order to really live a life of caring about, you have to learn to care for. And in order to live a life of caring for that is not fundamentally classist and privileged, you also have to learn to care about. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.